Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Chris Bloom, 25 years of career experience, currently fire chief for Meridian Fire Department in Idaho. Chris is a chief that wholeheartedly believes in a mission-driven culture. The chief position was never on his radar, but sometimes individuals need to rise up and step in uncomfortable and uncharted territory. Some of Chris's viewpoints are outside training, embracing the mission-driven culture, and my favorite quote, "Why you do the job is more important than where you do the job." With that, I present Mr. Chris Bloom.
Hello, my name is Chris Bloom, and I have a pretty cool story about how I ended up in the fire service. I started out as a lifelong servant leader. I was in the Boy Scouts. I served communities as I grew up as a young man across the country. And when I say that, it's because I was a product of a military family, and so we went relocated. And the common thing across all of those relocations was giving back and serving in some capacity. And so when I was in college at the University of Arizona, I was pursuing a track for being a physician. I wanted to go to medical school. And in the summer of my senior year, or the summer before my senior year, I was working in an emergency room as a technician. And it was recommended to me that I go see how, you know, patients are taken care of and treated before they get to the hospital. So I took an EMT class. And at the end of the EMT class, there was this, hey, you know, Tucson Fire Department is hiring. And I said, you know, that'd be kind of cool just to see what that's all about. And so I went out for a intro day I put the turnouts on, the face mask, SCBA, and the air pack, and it hit my blood. So I remember I called my parents and I said, hey, you know, I think I'm going to put medical school on hold. I want to do this thing. I want to be a firefighter. And my dad assured my mom, oh, it's just a phase. It'll pass. And it hadn't. I mean, it was in the blood, and I wouldn't change a single decision or a single second or a single moment of the past 25 years. So this has been a wonderful ride thus far, and ups and downs, hard times, great days, bad days, wouldn't change one of them.
Awesome. So from potential Chris Bloom MD initials to Chris Bloom firefighter.
You know something, that's the one title that you earn. It doesn't matter if you become a lieutenant, a captain, your family and your community and the profession will always recognize you as a firefighter. And so that for sure is the title that I'm most proud of, is that I am a firefighter, and I earned the privilege to call myself a firefighter because it's a sacred duty and a sacred mission. And, you know, it doesn't matter how far away from the line I've gotten, my heart always is with the men and women that are on the line doing the work day in and day out, you know, keeping the promise.
Fantastic. All right. Love to hear it. With that being said, you are the fire chief for Meridian Fire Department in Idaho. Can you explain, for those that don't know, including myself, your department size, calls, your staffing level, things of that nature?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, Meridian, Idaho, this was actually a unique transition for me. I spent a career and was retired out of the city of Tucson Fire Department, which is a metro agency. Meridian, Idaho, and the Treasure Valley, that where Meridian is in Idaho, is southwestern central, if that makes sense at all, Idaho. And that's home for me, and that's sort of my family was all from Idaho. And so the opportunity to come home, in a sense, was near and dear to my heart, if that was an opportunity that was available for me. And lo and behold, it came up, and you know, it was a transition coming from a metro agency to a smaller agency. But I would say this, and when I mean a smaller agency, when I got here, there were about 90 members on the line, single battalion, and six operating out of six fire stations. What I think is really important to take away from that is, coming up here, I recognized it didn't matter if it was at a metro agency or a smaller agency, or, you know, a smaller jurisdiction. The challenges and the opportunities, more importantly, the opportunities are the same in both. So I you know, there, it's a distinction in kind. It's not really a big difference. It's just a different distinction of the size of the organization. And ultimately what I would tell you is that the family close connectedness in a six station, 80, 90 member department is much stronger than it was in a larger metro agency. You know, you'd go 6 months, 6 years without seeing somebody that you went to the fire academy with. And the next thing you know, they're retiring. You're like, holy cow, where have they been for the past 6, 8, 10, 12 years? And that doesn't happen in the smaller agencies. And so Meridian Fire Department over the past 3 years has grown from 80 to 90. I don't remember exactly, but now we're to 136 members on the line, operating out of 8 fire stations. And, you know, with a call volume right around, I believe, 15,000 calls a year. It is a all-hazards paid professional department that does not transport EMS, but does respond to EMS runs with a paramedic, with the intent being having a paramedic on every piece of rolling apparatus that goes on call. So,
okay. All right. So your EMT / paramedic based, no transport. What's your minimum staffing across your apparatus?
Oh man, you're getting right at it. Minimum staffing. So, so when I got up here, with the, you know, wonderful union leadership up here, they had a contract in place that required minimum staffing was three writing positions every shift. And again, with that experience that I'm in the back of my, well, the experience that I had had previously, I was like, I don't know how you do it with three. And so I was adamant. I've been adamant. I will continue to be adamant about pursuing a four-person staffing model across all shifts on all apparatus. And very fortunately, at least in my mind, and it's a very challenging decision for elected officials to accept a SAFER grant. And we were very fortunate, in my opinion, to have received a SAFER grant last year to move us up to meeting that 1710 standard of four-person staffing. And we're in the current recruitment to continue to fill those vacancies that have been created by having a SAFER grant. And so that kind of answer, we're in this transition phase. And it's so interesting when you look at an organization and you talk with them, they did so much with so little for so long, mm-hmm. that they didn't realize that having that fourth person is a massive force multiplier for, you know, we need to be outcomes driven, and having four people provides a better outcome for the members of the community. And certainly it makes it safer for our firefighters operating on the fire ground. And, you know, I don't think that the 1710 standard is capricious. I think it's based in science and in good fact. And I can absolutely attest to the efficiency that is created with a four-person staffing model versus a three.
Okay. All right. With that being said, what is your rank structure like as far as on the apparatus?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So on every apparatus, and so, like, hang on, let me back that up. So on our engines and ladder trucks, we have, well, with the SAFER grant, we're going to have two backseat firefighters. We have an engineer, driver, operator, FAE, whatever you want to call them, and that's their single role. And then we have a captain. And in those three, we don't want the captain to be the paramedic on an incident if we can avoid it. But we, within either the engineer or one of those two backseat firefighters, we have that role filled, dual roled as a paramedic and a firefighter.
Okay.
And then we do have a battalion chief, and they're a single resource. They're a single person in a command rig.
Okay. And as far as operations, do your engines do engine work? Trucks do truck work? Is it specific?
Man, you got some great questions, Danny. So this is an interesting thing, because while we want that to be the case, and that is the best model, that a truck shows up and does truck work, an engine shows up and does engine work. We're kind of caught in that paradigm of not quite big enough of an agency. And what I mean by that is I would love to have sole purpose, dedicated ladder trucks and type one pumpers. But unfortunately, we have our response district and broke up in such a way that, you know, we have a ladder truck that's responding first due to a fire without hose, pump, and water. With the second due, you know, how far is second due? I mean, if you're in the rearview mirror, that's not a problem. But if you're, you know, you're 4 miles away, that becomes an issue, because at every single fire event that's a confirmed working incident, I know for a fact I need one thing. I need several things. I need a well-trained crew on a fire engine that's bringing the hose, pump, and water to place a line between the fire and savable victims. And having a delay in that is kind of problematic. The solution, in my mind, is obvious, but it's expensive. You know, you need multi-company stations where when the tones drop, you got a truck and an engine. They're chasing each other to the fire, and then the truck does truck work, engine does engine work. So right now we're just at a model of not the best or most efficient model. And so this is where the dirty word of the quint gets brought in. And so our reserve truck and our we have a frontline quint and a reserve quint, and then we have a dedicated ladder company. But that's why we still have a toe in the water with the quint, because again, that the placing, you know, getting water between the fire and that rescue profile is paramount.
No, I totally understand, and I can't argue your sentiments. It's one of those questions people, you know, love to argue about, but it has to make sense for your department, and so I totally understand your reasoning.
Yeah, it's not the best case, right? I mean, obviously we want our dedicated truck people doing truck work and engine doing engine work. That, like I said, that works until it doesn't. And you know, the last thing that I want to have happen is our dedicated staff showing up, you know, our dedicated committed staff showing up to a fire on a ladder truck, and the one resource that they need to effect a rescue or do it is water, and they don't have it. I mean, okay, great, they have a PW can, cool, but they're not as effective, you know. But that combined interior attack with, you know, ventilation and VEIS and all of the great things that a truck company does, that's the best of both worlds. But getting there is expensive. It makes sense, but you know, it's very expensive.
Okay, understood. With that being asked, this is kind of more like a personal question. So currently, you know, you are the fire chief. So I'm gonna kind of have you go back in time a little bit. Was that always the goal that you wanted to do, or was it something that just, you know, not like sprung up, but you saw an opportunity and you were like, maybe, and then you went for it?
Man, great question, and I will be very honest with you. So when I got through the fire academy, when I was going through the fire academy, I wanted to do one thing, and that was be a paramedic. On a paramedic transfer, I wanted to be, you know, Johnny and Roy. That's what I wanted to do. And I worked at Tucson Fire Department. It's a very busy metro agency, very busy. And the paramedics, man, they are the red-headed stepchild of the fire service. And, you know, you just get kind of beat up in that role. And there was a point in my career, about 10 years into my career, that I was like, man, I don't know if I can do this for the next 25 years like everybody else's. But I don't know that I want to promote. I don't know that being a captain, I'd be good at it. I don't know if I'd be good at it. And I had a couple of very important mentors in my life that convinced me that, it's worth going after if you think that you could do it. So I think I could do it. And so I'm probably what you could call the accidental fire chief in many groups. I never set out to be a fire chief. In fact, I went to the National Fire Academy and the Executive Fire Officer Program, and I remember graduation year 4, I'm sitting in there in the classroom, and we're kind of going and doing a round table, and hey, what's next for you? Everybody's kind of answering, well, you know, I want to be a fire chief. And I remember sitting there like, I can't lie to these fellow classmates. I don't know what's next for me. I genuinely did not have this intrinsic ambition or drive to pursue the position of fire chief. And you know, so I got to, you know, I ended up being a battalion chief and doing some really cool things as a chief officer. And, you know, I just had reached a point in my career where I was like, man, I've kind of reached the end of the road organizationally, but I have a lot of gas left in the tank. And, you know, so when I saw the opportunity to give back more to the profession, to our craft, to do the job at a higher level and continue to serve, I was like, well, I think I could do this. I think I could pursue it. And so there certainly wasn't any arrogance in the pursuit. I'll tell you, in the first year I was in the seat as the fire chief, there's a lot of imposter syndrome that I had personally. I was like, man, I found my feet and I got them under me and I really felt like, you know, I've been successful. The fire chief is never a popular role, and there's two ways you end up leaving as a fire chief. You either retire or you get fired. And so once you assume that mantle of fire chief, you do recognize that there's two ways you're going to exit, and you need to pick your time. And so you need to be effective while in the seat, in the position, until you're not. And you know, you hope you recognize it's like, hey, it's time for me to move on. When it's right for you and not getting forced out. And I know there are some people that just hold on to it like a death grip, like, well, heck, I got to make it to my pension. I got to make it to, well, I hope you're serving your organization well if you have reservations about why you're in the position.
I love the answer, Chief. Awesome. Okay. With that being said, I'm going to kind of ask you the first or the second official question.
Okay.
What does the term aggressive mean to you as the fire chief? Because it is a popular debate
love
hearing takes from chief officers, especially chiefs.
It is, you know. I don't know. Danny, is this going to be on? Is this going to be the video is going to be on there?
No, sir. I only do audio, but you can explain whatever you're doing.
So it's interesting because for your listeners, you know, I'd encourage them to open their Fire Engineering magazine of September 2024 this year and read David Rhodes's editorial.
Ooh, yes, sir.
Yeah, talking about search culture, lack of search culture. It's interesting because you know something at the outset, I'll tell you right off the bat, I want aggressive firefighters. Aggressive, in my mind, shouldn't be a binary decision. Aggressive does not mean intelligent. Aggressive does not mean well-trained. And I think that what we need to do is make sure that when we say aggressive, we're talking about intelligently aggressive firefighters. When you are a firefighter who is well-trained, well-equipped, well-resourced, now you get the opportunity to act intelligently and be aggressive. I think that, you know, and again, like I said, I don't know that it's a binary term because the opposite of aggressive is weakness. It's not aggressive. It's not proactive. It's not embracing, you know, keeping the promise of searching for savable victims and risking a lot to save a lot. So, like I said, I kind of struggle with the binary that aggressive as a standalone term means the alternative is we're not aggressive. What I would argue is that what we need to be is intelligently aggressive. And like I said, you do that through proper training, equipping, and resourcing your firefighters. And when they have that, they have confidence in their skill. They have confidence. They have reps and sets. They know what they're going to do. And my expectation is in an emergency scene, my expectation is if they show up at my house, they're going to be aggressive. And so I can't have a two-standard approach to this. I think that aggressiveness is achieved through, again, training, education, resourcing, and equipping our firefighters so that they're best positioned to be aggressive when, you know, aggressive fire ground. And I'm assuming we're talking about in the context of fire ground operations.
Correct.
not being aggressive with one another at the fire station,
No,
but
no.
taking aggressive action, that's what saves lives. I mean, not being aggressive is safe in the extreme, and we want our people to be safe. And again, safe and intelligent can coalesce around the idea that if they're safe and they're intelligent, then yes, they can operate aggressively. But it's as the chief and the chief officers and the command staff, we have to make sure that we're doing everything that is necessary, again, through resource training, equipping, and resourcing our members so that they can perform that way.
Okay. With that being said, with you being the fire chief of your organization, what are your standards for your members and what are your non-negotiables?
Oh, interesting. So this is a great question. Actually, I'm going to kind of take this off a little bit off track. And I've talked about this in the past, but I'll talk about it here as well. I think that the deviation from standard is supported by what we're working on implementing here in Meridian Fire Department is a mission-driven culture. And mission-driven culture is predicated on leader's intent, and it's supported by the fire officer and the firefighters, the entire company, being well versed in what is the task, what are we being asked to do, what is the purpose, why are we doing it, and what is the desired end state. And if they take action that is consistent with our mission, vision, and organizational values, regardless of the outcome, it's my job to support them. And I'll give you an example, and I know maybe some of all of what I just said is confusing, but I can use a couple of examples of the demonstration of a mission-driven culture. About a year ago, we had a company officer that showed up to a witnessed code arrest, CPR in progress. So now we got a savable life. And this fire officer showed up in a beautiful fire apparatus to a locked gate. And they sat there, and the MDT told them, hey, code is 1234, and they're trying everything, they're getting their Knox box keys, they're trying it. And the company officer said, push the gate. Get to the patient. And man, they destroyed the gate and they busted the windshield and door. And you know something? On the back side of that, this company officer was like, well, I'm going to probably take paper. I'm going to get written up for this, that, and the other. And that company officer and that crew had a different experience. Because when we saw this as a command staff, we said, well done. That's exactly what you needed to do. And again, what was the outcome? Well, they put hands on the patient. They achieved ROSC. Patient walks out of the hospital 2 weeks later. Regardless of that outcome, the intent and the task and why they were doing what they were doing supports the mission of why we're here. I go back to I don't know, maybe your audience is too young for this one, but I love the movie Days of Thunder. Rubbing is racing. Our apparatus, our turn, they're all just tools. They're not to be, they're to be worshipped and they're to be taken care of, but they're to be used and they're to be used responsibly in the pursuit of saving people's lives. And so if we break a windshield saving a life, great, let's break two next time. There is no, and again, I can support that by saying, if you went to that family and said, what was your mom's life worth? Was it a $1,500 gate, an $800 windshield? I'll make a payment plan with you. I want you to do that again next time. And so that's us again. I keep hammering this up, we're keeping the promise, and that's a sacred duty and oath that we have to the communities that we're privileged to serve. And so I don't want our people to move through an emergency situation with hesitation. I want them to be deliberate and I want them to be thoughtful, but hesitation, that gets people killed. And hesitation, in that case, delayed treatment of a would have delayed treatment of a patient. And so that's to answer your question in a long, really long with a story embedded in there, is I think that this is how the American Fire Service moves forward, is by embracing and adopting a mission-driven culture. Not every moving, every time an apparatus gets a scratch in it, or every time an axe head breaks off, or every time an air pack gets damaged, it doesn't, there shouldn't be an administrative knee-jerk reaction that says, well, somebody's getting written up. Who's responsible? And if that's the case, you know who's responsible? You, Chief. You are responsible. You're ultimately going to be the one that's responsible for the attitudes, behaviors, actions, and outcomes that occur on your line's membership. So support them. Support them where it's appropriate. Now, again, negligence and intentional damage and misuse, that's in a complete different category. But that should be understood, that we do have a distinction between supporting the mission and negligence or intentional damage.
Man, first off, I will say, side note, it's funny you brought it up. You mentioned Days of Thunder. There was a scene shot in Mooresville, North Carolina, where I work for. So
okay,
that's pretty
well,
awesome.
Hey man, you're in NASCAR
Well, yeah,
I don't know about worse.
I don't know if we can say that now. NASCAR is definitely it's gone a little downhill. You know, it's not as popular. But anyways,
okay.
besides okay. that, back to what you said, Chief. It's very profound because you know you mentioned that the captain was like, "Hey, I'm probably getting paperwork for it." He owned it. He knew it. He was getting ready to take it. But the fact that your organization and your command staff recognize they were doing this to uphold the oath, to do the job. It's fantastic to hear because I know very many chief officers where if you damage a piece of equipment, let's say you're trying to better yourself in training, boy, does a nasty gram get sent out and the captain has to go, "Hey guys, just letting you know, you might need to be a little bit careful on the Halligan bar," or whatever the case may be. And it's like, you know, when we're trying to better ourselves, we're not intentionally trying to hurt or damage property. Things happen. And, you know, we should look at it as, hey, I was always taught this saying, I'm pretty sure it was told to me, if you're not getting in trouble for doing something right, you're obviously not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
so.
Fair.
Yeah. I love hearing that standpoint coming from you on that.
Yeah. It well, but again, it's born out of the experience of coming up through the fire service. My experience is no different than yours. I mean, you know, and you end up leading, it leads into this culture of people wanting to hide and cover up things. And, you know, it's like, man, I already got in trouble once this year I hope nobody finds out. And, you know, I also love the statement, you know, you can make mistakes, but you don't have to make my mistakes. And so if we're in a culture and an organization that fosters the notion of open, honest, transparent communications, it's like, yeah, maybe if you did damage a Halligan bar, and if you ever damage a Halligan bar, I'd love to hear about it. I don't know how you damage one of those things, but you run over it with an apparatus. But you know, what can we learn? What happened? And how can we learn? And I think that that's important for an organization to be learning and growing and evolving. Because, again, if you make a mistake on the training ground that damages a piece of equipment and nobody else hears about it, and nobody else learns from it, guess what's going to happen? We have doomed the people that are going to do that training evolution to the same failure. And so there's an opportunity to be a learning and growing organization. You know, and so, yeah, but again, my experience was born out of, you know, 21 years on the line and having very, very similar experiences.
Okay. All right. With that being said, the next topic, outside training, are you in favor for your members to get out of their bubble and learn something other than the Meridian way and bring it back to your members?
Emphatically, absolutely, without a question, 100% on board with that. I think that's one of the fatal flaws of the fire service is that, you know, it's we're going to train to a standard within our organizational confines, and I don't care what anybody else is doing. I don't care about Project Mayday. I don't care about NIST studies. I don't, and what we have seen, and I don't want to dime out any of the organizations because there's been some pretty significant tragedies that they have owned up to. And what I mean when I say they owned up to, they recognize that one of the fatal flaws that they had within their organizational training culture was that they were inbred. They've always done the same thing for the same reasons, and their communities changed. The buildings have changed. Strategy and tactics have changed. Best practices have changed. And they didn't allow their members to be exposed to that and be a learning, growing organization. And I mean, I'll tell you right now, I leverage as hard as possible the educational opportunities offered by the National Fire Academy. I think sending our peoples to Fools conferences and Women in Fire and FDIC and FRI, all of those things are excellent because the training might be good, but the connections and the relationships that you'll develop with people at similar and different departments is profound and invaluable. And that's where, you come back from a conference and 6 months goes by and you're still on a text thread with some people that you met there, and all of a sudden you need to come up with a new policy or a new strategy to deal with VEIS or whatever. And something, I had a conversation with somebody in another part of the country, and you can call them up and say, hey, what do you guys do? How do you, and honestly, if there's one thing that I know about the fire service is we will share. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you don't have to reinvent the wheel, and oftentimes people will give you a great blueprint that your department can say, keep this, leave that, forget this, this doesn't work here. And so it's just kind of like a menu, and it allows people to kind of select the things that are going to work better for them. But I think that the siloing of fire departments and isolating themselves, only having instructors from within their organization teach their people, I mean, it's probably not the most appropriate word, but like I said, it's inbreeding. I mean, all we're doing is we're recirculating the same ideas, the same messages amongst the same people, instead of having some outside influences that can provide, just a different view on a lot of things, let alone just different educational opportunities.
Love it. Love the answer. With that being said, I'm not sure this next question, I always like to kind of do a little pre-alert for. I'm not sure the operational budget in training for Meridian, but with you being who you are for your department, how do you bring, or how do you have your command staff bring realistic training to your members?
Oh, that's great. So yeah, fortunately we do budget responsibly to bring in leadership speakers as well as strategy and tactics. And it's funny that you bring this up because at this moment in time, the organizational membership asked for, hey, we'd like to be exposed to some different thoughts and some different, people in the industry. And so what I did is I worked with my team and we came up with a concept of calling, doing every 3 to 4 months, we're bringing in, and I've been very intentional about this, somebody at the rank of captain, no higher than battalion chief, to speak to the membership about an incident that they had, about a class that they put together, that they presented. And then we sort of use their conversation and transition at the end of their presentation to okay, so tell me what that means from your perspective, and how does what you dealt with there translate to this organization? And we just started doing that, and I'll tell you, we had somebody that you should have on your show, Chris Slayer, out of Mesa, Arizona. He's a battalion chief, a phenomenal guy. We brought him up, and he did a presentation on mid-rise and high-rise, and that is exactly what's being built in this community, and so pens were flying, and it was just great information transfer. And so answering your question is we're constantly evolving that. We are looking at ways of bringing in training. We brought in the Firefighter Air Coalition in March and did a national training symposium here in Meridian. You know, we had 100 people from, I think, 13 or 14 states and 20 different departments. So it was fantastic. And so that was sort of, again, bringing that training. You know, we were talking about developing that diversity of network. Well, we were able to bring that training on site here. And so we are focused on that. And again, I think it's just about getting exposure to different thought processes and ideas. And, you know, yeah, that's what we're working on right now. But yeah, the Command and Courage series is something that we're going to do. And I already have the next year worth of people that are going to be coming up and presenting lined out. And I mean, it's a lineup. We're excited about it.
No, that's awesome. That's awesome. It's not very often that you hear, I mean, there are, I'm sure that there are plenty, but there are also horror stories you hear of, yeah, I tried to put in for this class and my department denied it, or my chief or my, you know, my training captain or training chief said, absolutely not. And, you know, yep. Hearing that, it's unfortunate because, you know, you're not letting that member's knowledge and training and experience grow outside of, you know, your four walls.
Well, and that's, I think that in fact, you just captured that perfectly. That's exactly the point.
I'm going to hit on your personal opinion, recruitment and retention.
Okay.
What do you feel like the fire service is doing good at, but where do you see the fire service can improve on regarding those two words?
Wow. You know, and it's a platitude, and I think I saw it on somebody's Facebook page, but I agree with it. It's like, if you do a good job taking care of your people, you don't have a recruitment problem, something to that effect. But I do agree with that. And so nationally, I understand recruitment is a challenge for the American Fire Service. I hear from my peers all across the country, you know, recruitment events are down. Very fortunately, uniquely, here in the city of Meridian, we don't have that problem, very fortunately. You know, we have an academy open for 14 people, and we had 770 applicants for 14 spots. And so I know that that's not a shared experience across the fire service, but I think that as, you know, culture and generational changes have sort of taken place, public safety, public service. I mean, if we're having this conversation about the fire service, I would not want to be in a conversation if I was in law enforcement. I don't know how they dig out. So I would just say broadly, public safety is having a challenge, but not nearly as much as law enforcement or law enforcement brothers and sisters. But from a fire service perspective, it's, you know, again, that generational cultural change, just a natural transition in just generational dynamics where, you know, public safety isn't the first choice of a lot of people. And of the people that have left the profession with 3 to 5 to 10 years have left, not because they didn't like the fire service, but because they wanted to go have a different life experience. I did that. I'm going to go. And whereas I think, you know, for my generation of fire service professionals, when we got on the job, we felt like we had won the lottery and you were going to have to pry me out of here tooth and nail. I was staying for 25 plus because I need that pension and the, you know, the deferred comp or the drop plan or whatever. I mean, people, I'm not going anywhere. And so that sort of changed a little bit. And you know, and I think that, again, as cultural dynamics change, and, you know, I never thought that it being a YouTuber or a TikToker would ever be a profession. That now they're multimillionaires. I mean, right. Hey, people, I'm willing to try my hand at this.
Right.
I'm not, there's not a lot of risk in me trying to pursue that as an ambition. Whereas the fire service, rightfully so, has standards and rigorous standards and very challenging fire academies. And the challenges to being successful as a firefighter are much higher than some other professions, just broadly. You know, I don't know what the challenges are to being, you know, well, I don't want to belittle any other profession or any other craft, but the barriers to getting into the fire service are challenging. And I think that for a lot of people, it's just like, I'm going to just try something else. Or I tried for the fire department once and didn't get selected, and that's not in the cards for me. Whereas, again, generationally, I knew people in my fire academy that had tested for 10 years, 10 different or 12 different times with 8 different departments. And then finally, they felt like they won the lottery. And so that, again, that's not good, bad, or otherwise. That's just the challenge I think that we're starting to see with the fire services. Well, and let me transition away a little bit from that. So it's a deadly profession. We're killing on average, 9/11 notwithstanding, we're killing 100 firefighters a year, so it's a dangerous profession. Oh, that by the way, you have a exponentially higher risk of acquiring occupational cancer, that heart attack is the leading cause of death for our firefighters. And I know you and I had a little bit of an offline conversation of some of the challenges that we've recently experienced in the past week. But so if I'm working in another profession that's maybe more office oriented, I don't have to worry about those things. I don't have to worry about falling through a roof. I don't have to worry about getting, running out of air. I don't have to worry about getting an occupational cancer. So again, I think that truth in advertising is working for us, but it's not to our benefit. I mean, people know better now what it means to get into the fire service, and maybe that is a deterrent for some people. I mean, certainly those weren't mentioned to me, and I didn't even think about them when I, young and invincible, I didn't even think about those things. So I think that that's some of the challenges with the recruitment. But when it comes to the retention piece, again, I'm very fortunate with where I'm at today. I don't have a problem with retention. We have a dedicated, committed workforce that's not looking to go anywhere else. We're not losing people from this organization to go to another organization. And so if I were to look at how that dynamic is occurring, I believe, again, it's like I said, it's because of the brotherhood and the sisterhood that the membership of this department on the line provide with one another. And we had just recently done a survey. So we're doing a strategic plan, and people were allowed to write in whatever they wanted to talk about. And some of the pertinent negatives that were really important about looking at the responses is we had nobody that spoke of discrimination, harassment, abuse, hazing. Nobody talked about they had lack of equipment, the poor facilities, poor maintenance of the apparatus. So some of the things that administrators kind of focus on, evidently, we're doing good with, So I think that speaks to retention. And then also I think that, the fire service is really sort of engaging in this, when it comes to retention. I think that there's a lot of terms that get thrown around, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. Well, I'd throw a lot of those out, and I'd stick with two. I'd stick with inclusion and belonging. And the inclusion piece, in my mind, is what is the spirit of your organization? Do we allow people to show up authentically, be who they are, within the constraints of our mission, vision, and values, and our, I'm not talking about people showing up with purple hair and face tattoo. I'm talking about people being able to show up authentically, be who they are, and feel included in that team environment. And I think that when you build an organization with inclusion at the outset, where, once you're in this department, you are us. Like, we are all one. We're a family. We're a team. We want you to show up authentically. We want you to be loved. We want you to be respected. We want you to be appreciated for who you are as a member of our team. And so that inclusion lends itself to this notion of belonging. How do we make sure that we're maintaining in this realm of retention? How do we make sure people continue to feel like they belong here? Not that they had to fight tooth and nail to get here, but no, you belong here. This is your department. You are a valuable member, and we care about you, and we don't want you to go anywhere. And so I think that, like I said, I mean, I just really like to focus in on that inclusive environment that provides a sense and a meaning of belonging to an organization. And I think that if we're able to look at our profession in that through that lens, I think that we would be well on our way of preserving retention of our membership.
Oh, that's outstanding. And you hit it on the nail, or you hit it on the head, you know, with those two words, because you know it's you see it or you hear about it. You know, certain departments will not take on the applicant that has the experience and the training and the background, but rather yet they would rather go and, okay, well, statistically showing our department is lacking in this
yep.
criteria.
Yep.
And,
yep.
And I will say, like, my point of view, I'm not, most firemen that I have talked to since I've done this do not care male, female, sex, religion, creed. All they want is someone that's going to do the job, do it well, and hold down the fort when things get tough.
Amen, brother. That's spot on.
You know,
spot
so when we have, and I know there are individuals out there, they have problems where, you know, the organization allows human resources to kind of dictate, no, we need this individual. Like, respectfully,
yep.
I understand what you're saying, but mm-hmm. I can say, and this is coming from me, my personal belief, I don't like whenever I hear organizations say, well, we want our fire department to reflect our community.
Mm.
Because to me, if the individual wants to be a firefighter, they will find you, especially in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
People will find you. And you know what I mean? Like, so the whole thing of we want our department to look like, I get it,
yeah.
but it's,
yeah.
I mean, that's an old school way of thinking.
Yes. Well, so I appreciate that you've kind of brought it up in that context, because, you know, when we talk about diversity, and I'm not trying to rain on anybody's parade here, but I really feel like when I hear the term diversity, I'm hearing race, gender, sex, religion, and what I'm more importantly, what I'm hearing is a baseball card collection. I've got three of these and four of those. It's like,
yes.
Well, how is that fostering this inclusive membership of belonging, whereby you end up with members that may feel, well, I'm only here because I'm the token fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
That's not fair to them. And again, I think that, you know, once we're able to just, you know, and I think that this is things that people don't understand that aren't part of the craft, that are part of the profession, that we are a family. We do lock arms, brother, you know, arms and with brothers and sisters. And we fight for each other, and we fight for the communities together. And again, I think that it's divisive language when we start talking about, you know, mandating the hiring of any specific group or denying any specific group. It's like that's not fair to the community or the people that are applying, or, you know. So I very much appreciate what you said, because again, I'm dealing exactly with what you have described. You know, it's challenging. I mean, if you were to look at, and I mean, this is just being transparent and honest. If you were to look at the demographics of the state of Idaho and the Treasure Valley and Meridian, I want to say we're 88% white. So does that mean that my department needs to be 88% white and 2% Hispanic and 3%? That is so narrow-minded and backward thinking in my mind.
Yes.
It's like, I want open recruitment. I don't need to see. All I need to see is, can you do the job? Do you want to be here? And do you have a GED and no felony convictions? And if you check those boxes, come on in.
Right.
Come on in. We will make you a firefighter.
No, that's the truth. And like you said, you know, I always, since I started this and even beforehand, like, I've always been very outspoken and vocal on things I believe in. And, you know, me being I'm actually Haitian American, I knew coming into this field that the fire service has historically always been predominantly white. Like, it's
mm-hmm.
okay.
It's not
like we don't need to go. It's kind of like, I definitely equate this to the NFL and specifically the Washington Redskins. I just read an article that they are potentially going back to the Redskins because the Native Americans were like, we weren't a, like, where did this come? We were not offended. Like, it's paying homage. So I love hearing that fact. And, you know, I think if more and more people realize your department is going to reflect your demographics, period. End of story. As long as we're hiring the right candidates and they can do the job and do it well, let's move on.
Bigger fish to fry, maybe.
No, definitely bigger fish to fry for sure, for sure. With that, my next topic on leadership, whether company officer or chief officer, what do you look for? What do you expect mainly from individuals that want to take on that role?
That's a great question. So there always is, and rightfully so, you're looking, people should have personal ambition. Like they should want to do it. But hopefully that ambition is backed up with the heart being in the right place as well. Meaning that they want to do it because they feel that they can offer something more to the crews that they're going to be serving, to the community members that are going to need them in the time of emergency. And so having the head and heart in the right place at the outset, I think is really important. We can have, I don't want to make this sound too cheap, but you really want people that can think. And I say that in broad and general terms because you can have somebody who is very book smart, very much able to memorize, rote, blah, da, 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 da. Friction loss and pump pressures. I mean, they can memorize the things, but if any of those variables change on them, they're completely lost. So in a testing environment, maybe they do very well, but in the real world application, they struggle. And I think that is one of the challenges with the training, well, selecting, training, and promoting people is eliciting from them their authentic ability to be a thinking officer. And what I mean by that is, we train people to memorize the SOPs, the SOGs, the individual performance standards, the company performance standards, all of these things. And that's in a very sterile environment. And then what we do is we put them in an environment where everything is ambiguous. How many times have you gone on a call that what you got sent for didn't match what you showed up to? So this is the point. We need somebody that can think and adapt and change. It's like what I'm seeing does not match what I've trained myself for. So what do I do now? And that's what I mean by thinking. And I can't underscore that enough is having people that are critical thinkers that can make good, values-driven, mission-focused decisions in stressful environments. And I think that that's one of the challenges when we're selecting or creating processes and promoting people is we want to make sure that we have people that are critical thinkers.
Okay. And the fight, we need that. We need officers who don't just know what they read in the textbook. Like, the textbook information, building construction, things of that nature, it is important. But I also like to call the officer needs to have a little bit of street knowledge too.
Amen. Street knowledge. That's a great way to put it. And it's funny, I'm getting old enough now that it doesn't resonate with everybody, but we used to call it, slides in the carousel. Remember the carousel? So how many slides do I have, that I can overlay that give me the best tactical or strategic decision to make in this environment? I don't have that slide, but I have some very similar. And so that's again, it's and street knowledge is just acquired by years and years of showing up and doing the job.
Definitely. Okay. I'm gonna ask you this question.
All right, let's do it.
When to say when to a recruit or an individual that's not cutting it? And I say this to say, you mentioned it earlier, the applicant pool across the nation, numbers are down. And you have certain organizations or some organizations that will, hey, we need bodies on trucks. Once they get through their recruit academy or whatever, they're good to go. And let's just say you hear, hey, chief, this individual's not cutting it. And they're like, well, we need bodies, make it work. What's your take on having to tell an individual, hey, we appreciate you, but you're just not it?
Yeah, great question. And this is very hard. These are some very challenging discussions. And I feel like I'm in a good place that we can talk about this. It is never our intent to make a job offer to somebody that we don't think is going to be successful in completing the academy and completing their probation. What we have is a very strict standard. And the expectation of those recruits is you will meet this standard. There is not two standards. There is not a reduced standard for certain people and an increased standard. There is the standard, and we maintain that. And that makes it very easy, or it makes it less challenging, rather, during the academy. The expectations are clear from day one. That they understand what they need to do to be successful. It's very much laid out for them. They're given weekly updates on how they're doing, how they're progressing, where they're at, how they performed, how they're, a multi-level inventory of what they're doing week by week. And so then at the point you get somebody that is they're in an unrecoverable place to complete the academy, it makes it pretty easy to have that conversation. Well, again, it's not ever easy, but it's not coming out of left field. We have a standard, and you clearly did not meet it. And so that makes it palatable in the training environment. But then once you transition to the line, and this is where you have to have a very mission-focused training staff. When that person graduates, that training staff is putting that stamp of approval on that person, says they're going to be successful. And so they need to take that serious, because it's not just go along, get them through. They're going to hit the line, and we're going to send them to this really, strict captain, and they'll figure it out there. So there has to be an understanding that the people are graduating, they're all getting, in this agency, three captain stamp of approval, the division chief of training stamp of approval. So they own the future performance of that firefighter at the fire stations. What the heck is going on with so and so? What do you mean? We had no problem with them in the fire academy. Here was their performance. Here's where they were strong. Here was where they needed to improve. So there's no ambiguity in that. Once they're on the line, again, there are very specific performance metrics that they need to meet, and they need to show up and do the job at an exceptionally high standard. But it's not a different standard; it is the standard. And so we have, the evaluation process. And honestly, at the point where we need to dismiss somebody, it's no surprise that there's not like this came out of left field. I mean, there are tears most often than not because, I mean, there's tears on both sides of the table because nobody wants to feel like they're taking away somebody's dream. But the reality is they gave up on their dream because we will do everything that is reasonable to make sure that people have the tools, the training, the equipment to be successful in the roles that they're being placed in. And if they're not successful, there needs to be a little bit of personal onus that, hey, I could have done better. I should have done better. And unfortunately, it does lead to a separation of service. But what I can tell you, at this department, all of those become a grievable and appealable process through our union. And, we're batting 1,000 right now on making the right decision.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Last question for you. And I always like to tell, or I always like to state this first. This question is not to boast or brag on any individual. I just genuinely
Okay.
love hearing the response. With that being said, you are kind of you're there. So what I always ask the guests is, where do you see yourself in the future? You know, whether it's company officer, fire chief, which you are. So I want to hear, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it up and retire?
Wow, that's a pretty deep question. Well, I mean, to start off and answer just bluntly, I've exceeded the expectations of what I thought I was going to do in this career to begin with. What I am discovering is I'm having more and more doors of opportunities opening up. For me, I mean, opportunities to go speak at national training, events, instructing at the National Fire Academy. Those are things that energize me and keep me engaged, keep me relevant in the profession. And I think that if ever there's the day that I am not excited to come into work, how about this? If there's ever the day 2 days in a row that I'm not excited about coming into work, I'll probably consider hanging it up. And hanging it up in the sense of moving on to something else. And much like the entirety of my career, I never had these incredible aspirations of doing. I just kind of did the work, showed up, and the progression was just natural and normal for me. And I'm hoping, that as doors continue to open up, I put my best foot forward, that I honor, the craft and the profession and the men and women that, I'm so privileged to call brothers and sisters and serve arm in arm with. So I just hope that I continue to do that. And if ever there's the day that I feel like I'm not doing that, I hope I have enough emotional intelligence to recognize it's time to step away. So.
Fantastic. I can't argue with the answer. Love it. Love it, Chief. Love it. With that being said, before we end this conversation, is there anything you want to let any of the listeners know out there, whether it's any sort of guidance or inspiration, something out there for that could help someone?
Never forget why you got into the job. Never forget how excited you were when you got that phone call that said, "Hey, you're coming on board with whatever agency you're at." And honestly, why you do the job is much more important than where you're doing the job.
Absolutely, sir.
And so you need to just recognize that it is a national brotherhood and a sisterhood. You have brothers and sisters across the world that care about you, that care about our profession. And I just would sign off with my little mantra is that we need to serve the work. We're here to be excellent at what we do, and that's how we serve the work. We serve the work by serving our communities. We serve it by serving one another, and we shouldn't let the job serve us. It's our job as public servants to serve the communities and serve the work. So that's what I would leave people with.
Facts. Love it. Love it. I had to write that quote down because that's going in
Okay. Serve the
in
work.
your own your opening
Danny,
speech, sir.
if you send me your information, I'll send you some stickers and a shirt. Here, I'll show you, since I'll wait till we're off.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. No, but other than that, Chief, I truly appreciate it. Like I said, in my with doing this, I've been a little bit hesitant to reach out to chiefs, but I want to speak to fire chiefs so I can hear their perspective. Other people that may know you can hear, oh crap, like damn, I didn't know the chief thinks like that. Because the chief is a very like we're gonna
I
leave
get it.
her alone. We don't
I
really
get it.
wanna. So I
I get it.
appreciate you accepting the invite, coming on and
Oh, it was an
spreading the
honor.
good word, sir. Thank you.
It was an honor. Absolute honor, Danny. Thank you for the privilege.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.